opportunity to protect home court and go into two of the best worsts ever, and that's game seven. You know, hopefully we protect home. That's all that matters.
Take it one game at a time. That's it. I couldn't really think about the what ifs or what could happen, what should happen. I can't really think of that. All I'm really thinking about is the moment that we're in and taking advantage of it.
In a lot of ways, you just try to stay out of their way when they're having such a night like that. Like Kyrie was, you know, unbelievable, shooting over 70% from the field. Bron has, you know, just been himself.
I have strong belief that if I play game five, we win. But I didn't, because I put myself in a situation where I wasn't able to play. And I think my teammates fought, and it's on me to come out and help that battle. Being a great team has got us this far. So to come back and be a piece of that great team is what I owe to this team. That's what I'm looking forward to doing.
I don't want to be a prisoner of the moment and say game five was a direct reflection of kind of who we are as a team and who I am as an individual, as a player, as a leader. And I was out there, you know, doing what I'm trying to do to help our team win, and it didn't work. So that happens in sports. It happens in our game, and nothing's going to stop me from coming back doing what I do to help lead my team in game six. Yeah, we have a chance to win a championship, so definitely the biggest game, and I'm ready for it.
Takes it out to the 48-yard line. Green sprints out. Sets the throw. Gets it off. Griffin on the sideline. He's got it. Archie's got a first down for the Bucks.
Eddie Jordan finds a hole. John Wooden runs him down, but it's a big one for Eddie.
The handoff by Hoynes to George in a foot race, and he gets away.
By Chris Fielder, and he might get in. Touchdown, 24 yards, touchdown, Ohio State. Spielman with his fifth interception this season,
which is remarkable for a linebacker. It's incredible.
Big block by the big man, Orlando Pace.
When you were at an Ohio State game, he might have been the guy you were watching when the ball was snapped.
Pearson behind Pace, touchdown.
Creating imaginary statistics, one of them called the pancake, which I don't remember ever seeing in an NCAA record book. And so Orlando Pace led the country in pancakes.
So they have Jumbotron. Every time I would pancake somebody, they'll put one pancake in.
Pace is the pancake man.
I've had good players. Honestly, I don't know how good a coach I am. I've never particularly cared. I think I'm a terribly lucky coach. You give me the same material as anybody else, I think I'll beat him. All my luck, if nothing else.
All things say, I don't care if we win or not. We don't want him. Because we do want to win, because winning is the epitome of team effort. And we must keep that, and we must inculcate that into our football players.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
An absolutely brilliant montage put together once again by the fabulous Jim Cushlin. What an outstanding job of laying out exactly what it is that we want to do today and that we're going to do today right here on this Thursday afternoon edition of the Extravaganza. Mr. Cushlin, stand up and take a bow, good sir.
Thank you.
That Buckeye montage.
Nice, where you just kind of.
That Buckeye montage was outstanding. I don't know where that sound is coming from, but it doesn't matter. That was tremendous. If you don't know why we just played a bunch of NBA sound for you, and then a bunch of Ohio State players from years gone by, because we're going to talk NBA Finals right here in the opening hour of the program. Coming up next hour, though, we're going to dive right back into the NFL.com series that they have, top 10 college football programs. Naming and identifying and carving out places for four faces from each of those 10 schools on their own Mount Rushmores. And you just heard, I think, some from Archie Griffin, a little from Eddie George, a little from Chris Spielman, a little from Woody Hayes. I don't even know. What did I miss? What else did you have in
there? A little Orlando Pace.
Orlando Pace,
to find
that's
calls
right.
For linemen.
I'll tell you what, that is outstanding. We had a great job doing that yesterday with Michigan. They added, by the way, Jim Cushlin, there were eight schools yesterday. They had two more to release. Today they released the ninth school, and that was the one I predicted. The Southern California Trojans, and they have identified the Mount Rushmore of great players out of USC, including Ronnie Lott, Anthony Munoz, Bruce Matthews, and Marcus Allen. We'll get into that a little bit later on. So a little bit of everything there for you in the montage, including Buckeye, Mount Rushmore nominees, and, of course, game number 6 of the NBA Finals. We took a break on Finals Talk yesterday. Wanted to just kind of decompress it a little bit, knowing we would ramp it up before they get ramped up tonight at Quicken Loans Arena out in Cleveland. It is going to be it is going to be something to see. The Cavaliers trying to become just the third team in NBA history to come back from the 3-1 deficit to even force a Game 7. And if they were able to win that one out in Oakland, they would actually, of course, be the first team to ever win an NBA Finals after trailing 3-1. Here to talk about it with us now as we break down Game 6 is our longtime friend and very frequent guest analyst on this program, the man who told us on Monday afternoon before Game number 5 that the Warriors would be drinking champagne later that night. He is our friend Dennis Maniloff from Cleveland, the Plain Dealer, and the Cleveland.com. D-Man, what's going on, brother?
What's up, my friends?
All right. Well, you know what's up. You made the call very definitively. I must also admit, I did not argue with you even a little bit because of how disheartened I was with the way the Cavaliers closed game number 4 in the fourth quarter. I didn't know they had that kind of life left in them. I thought on the road at Oracle with 48 minutes separating Golden State from back-to-back titles, I didn't argue with you, so I can't sit here and play, do the superiority dance. But what in the world are you thinking right now after you were so confident and I was right along with you that the Cavaliers could not do what they did end up doing, which is forcing a Game 6?
Well, let me be clear, first of all, Bob. I was resigned to the fact that I didn't think the Cavs could pull it out. By no means was I hoping that I would be right, because I can't stand the Warriors.
No, I wasn't suggesting that at all. This was straight-up prediction, not hoping or desiring, of course.
And, my original prediction before the series was the Warriors in 6 games, and here we are at Game 6. I'm not going to come off of that prediction. I didn't expect it to go quite this way. I thought Golden State would win 5. But listen, Golden State's argument is, we lost to 2 guys in Game 5. I mean, we lost to an historic performance by 2 players. It's never been done in the finals where 2 guys went for 40-plus. And LeBron and Kyrie each with 41, I think they accounted for 97 or 98 of the 112 points, either by assist or field goal. So that's why, I still believe that Golden State will win, is because I don't think that the Cavs can expect LeBron and Kyrie to replicate what they were able to do in Game 5. I just don't see the supporting cast being able to step up, specifically just one guy. I don't see even one guy other than Kyrie and LeBron being able to score 15 to 20 to help these guys out.
Before we get to finding another guy to help, let's talk about what they did, that historic performance. Why was it so impossible to think that the two of them could carry, particularly with Green out of Game 5, could carry their team to a win, maybe not with the historic both guys over 40 that nobody had ever done, but we all know that LeBron and Kyrie are two of the great players in this game. Offensively, especially Kyrie, maybe even a little bit more than LeBron, they're capable of what they did. We didn't see enough in games 3 and 4, perhaps, or 1 through 4, to think that they had that in them to come out and carry the way, especially against a missing Draymond Green Golden State defensive team?
Yeah, I wouldn't say, I never said it was impossible, but I did, when that game started, 41 and 41 were not dancing in my head. and I'm thinking, oh, okay, this is what they're going to do. Good luck against the Warriors, their team defense, even without Green, a big piece, by the way, of course, the captain of their defense. But even without Green, that's a really good defensive team. They're in their building. They're trying to, celebrate a championship. And, so I couldn't have anticipated 82 total points and the effectiveness that LeBron and Kyrie had. It wasn't just the points either. It was the efficiency. I mean, LeBron was, 16 of 30, and Kyrie was a ridiculous 17 of 24 from the field. So, the Warriors are going to say, hey, number one, we're comfortable playing at the Q. The past five games played at the Q, the Warriors have won four of them between the teams. Number two, LeBron and Kyrie are going to be hard-pressed to repeat what they did. Number three, we have Green back, who is the captain of the defense. He's going to sew up a lot of the leaks that they had communication-wise, in the paint, in transition. So, I think that Golden State can feel good about tonight. But having said that, Bob, there's no reason the Cavs can't feel good. There's no reason the Cavs can't feel excited. And they can also remember that just because Green is back doesn't guarantee the Warriors a win. I mean, all you have to do is go back to game three. You know, I mean, the last time I checked, Draymond Green played in that game, and the Cavs blew him out. So just because Green's on the court doesn't mean everything goes in favor of the Golden State Warriors.
Yeah, and you know what? That's very, very well said, and I'm glad to hear you kind of stick that in there, because I'm looking for a reason not to be as pessimistic as we were. And again, I'll take ownership of that too. As I said, I didn't argue with you. I kind of thought it would be over on Monday too. And I want to be more positive, and I have to believe that the Cavaliers understand that too. They know that the presence of Draymond Green does change things. And I know the momentum itself can't really carry over, especially when games are 3 days apart, you know, by the time they tip it off tonight. But there is something about confidence, the confidence level that says, you know what, look what we were able to do, especially LeBron from outside. And I think that is, again, what's going to happen. It is going, well, I mean, it's going to have to happen. That'll be the key, is whether or not LeBron is able to draw, whether it's Iguodala or Green or whoever is on him at a given time, out a little further, because he's hitting that mid-range jumper and, of course, the long ball, which he was very early and consistently in game four or game five. If he continues to do that, I don't want to say it erases Draymond Green, because it doesn't, but it gives him a lot better opportunity than when he wants to pull it down and get back into the paint and drive and continue to finish with either hand the way he always does. If he is clanking from out there like he has been for most of, well, really, quite frankly, most of 2015-16 season, if he's clanking again, then I think the odds are very, very long that the Cavaliers find enough juice either from those two guys or a helper to get there.
Well, a few things. First of all, I am glad that there's 2 days in between games as opposed to one. I don't know what the exact numbers are, but watching LeBron every game since he returned, I believe he is a much better player when he has more than 1 day's rest. So that helps the Cavaliers. More so maybe than the Warriors, because LeBron is the key to this whole thing, and he is older, and I think he needs the extra day of rest to help him out. You saw a less effective LeBron in game, what was it, five, when he only had 1 day off in between games. Number two, don't undersell the absence of Andrew Bogut for the Warriors. I think the Cavs get a break there. Bogut's out. Now, admittedly, not a huge piece, but a guy who, in what I think 60 minutes of this series, had blocked 10 shots or something to that effect. And was,
he became Bill Russell. This guy became Bill Russell back there, just the eraser at the rim. And I don't know, he's never been that before, but he was to the Cavs, especially in the first couple of games.
Right, and it's not just the blocks. It's the times where, you know, Cavs players maybe don't want to challenge him, or he alters their shot, or he changes their plan. So, Golden State's going to have to make an adjustment with Bogut out. It won't be an impossible task for him, but it's definitely a little speed bump that they're going to have to navigate. And the other thing is, you know, my sense, Bob, truly is this. If the Cavaliers are going to win tonight, there is going to have to be another guy in this mix, okay? I'm guessing LeBron and Kyrie are in the 60s combined instead of 82, all right? That means you're going to need, and I've kind of, in my head, I've just sort of created an imaginary number of like 105, and nothing scientific to that, just a gut, saying the Cavs need 105 points to win. So if I think LeBron and Kyrie are in the 60s, at least one or two guys is going to have to score 12 to 15. Maybe one guy scores 18 to 20 and the other guy scores 10. I just don't know who's capable of doing that. If you're the Cavs, that's,
We know who's capable. There's no question we know who's capable. It's a question of why it hasn't been done more consistently. And I would first, of course, go to J.R. Smith. We know he's capable of a 20-point night very easily, and especially at home where he seems more emboldened to take shots and he seems more confident taking shots, whether he's hitting his first few or not. He doesn't get gun-shy the way he does more often, it seems to me, at Golden State on the road. So that's a big, big part of this. The other part, though, is, in order for another guy to step up, and we'll talk about Kevin Love in a moment, obviously, because he's a big component of all of this. LeBron was even talking about that. But for another guy to step up, whether it be a JR or a Love or anybody else, they need shots and they need shot opportunities. And we all know that, what we decried as hero ball in game four, we were totally fine with, even though it was very, very close to being the same thing in game five. And that was, of course, LeBron and Kyrie taking an extraordinary amount of the shots each trip down, sometimes working with one another, sometimes isolating and doing their own thing, but they were scoring, so it was fine. But either way, nobody really looked for J.R. Smith in the second half. Nobody really looked for Kevin Love, who only had five shots in the entire game, much in the second half, much less any of the guys off the bench or Tristan Thompson, who just does his thing off the glass. So it's kind of hard to say, hey, can we get 20 out of one guy and 10 or 12 or 15 out of another guy if they're just not going to get shots because the two superstars are eating first at the trough?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, valid points you just made. My sense is that what the Cavs should do, by all means, is have LeBron and Kyrie try to do it again. That to me is your first option. Your first option to win this game tonight, plan A for the Cavaliers is see if Kyrie and LeBron or LeBron and Kyrie can carry you to victory. As I said, my sense is they won't be able to the extent that they did in game five. So as a result, you need to come up with, you need to come up with some alternatives. And that's where, if the shots aren't falling or if the opportunities aren't there for LeBron and Kyrie, if the space isn't as open as it was pre-Green or without Green, that LeBron and Kyrie will then try to get, help from their teammates. They're not going to just – I don't think they're going to force shot after force shot after force shot. I think they'll look to their teammates and say, okay, we need some help. Here's the ball. Here's your ball. Make the shot. And the question is, who's going to be able to do it?
Yeah, no question about it. We're talking to Dennis Manilow previewing game number six of the NBA Finals, a game that a lot of people didn't even think would exist, that the Warriors were going to close it out in home or at home in game five, especially after the way they just completely embarrassed and took the Cavaliers' heart in the fourth quarter of game number four. But yet here we sit, and we sit here despite the fact, we could talk about the Cavaliers' big three. The big three combined for what, 84 points against Golden State in game number five, 41, 41, and 2. We got to talk about Kevin Love, and I want to first listen to LeBron James talk about Kevin Love, and then I want to get your thoughts on what you think Tyronn Lue's decision-making is going to be like tonight when it comes to figuring out how much and when to play and how much to ask of Kevin Love in this game number six.
Go out and make an impact on the game, no matter if he's not scoring, no matter if at times you feel like he's not getting touches. We all just need to continue to be aggressive, and he needs to be aggressive to help us try to send this game back to Golden State. And I think he's looking forward to the challenge. I think he's looking forward for the moment, and we definitely need him. He's too big of a piece to our puzzle. We definitely need Kev to play better. We want him to play better, but, we don't want to add no more stress on him or no more added pressure on him. We just want him to go out and play. Just let it hang out.
Two things there, Dennis, I'd like you to comment on. One, the part about Kevin Love getting touches or not getting touches. But then, as LeBron said, when you do get your touches, we want you to be aggressive and try to score the ball. Does that mean force up bad shots? No. But be aggressive. Don't be so quick to defer back to one of us or anybody else. But then the second thing I want you to comment is on the comment that LeBron said made about we don't want to add too much stress on him. We don't want to make him whatever, however he phrased that, which is a clear indicator that what we have all seen, that this is a guy who is more emotionally fragile, I guess, if I can find it. It might be too harsh a word, but more emotionally fragile than a guy of his caliber and his contract should be. He's very sensitive to criticism. He's sensitive to, you know, if he doesn't think his teammates are buying into him or that they are, you know, considering him part of that puzzle, as LeBron just said. So from an aggressiveness standpoint and then from a mental standpoint, where is Kevin Love tonight and how does Tyronn Lue get the most out of him?
Yeah, but first of all, I think earlier in the hit I said game five was when the Cavs struggled. It was actually game four. I apologize for that.
Sure.
Regarding Love, we have a tendency with elite players or high-level players, however you want to categorize Love and All-Star, we want to package them all the same way. We want to think that they're all, you know, they're all incredibly mentally tough and there's no, there's no difference maybe to how these guys are. But Kevin Love clearly is a different cat and he has to be treated with kid gloves. He's not, he needs to be coddled. And LeBron recognizes that. He says it flat out in the soundbite. His teammates know this. They, for whatever reason, Kevin Love needs love. You know, and it doesn't.
Didn't the Beatles say that at one time? Isn't that all you need?
Well, yeah. It can't be tough love either. I mean, love kind of has to be told, "Hey, man, you're the man. We love you. You're great. You know, keep it up. You know." And I know you say, "Well, haven't you watched the games where LeBron's in his face?" Yeah, I mean, LeBron does yell at him. I think everybody gets yelled at except the King. So Love needs to be, he just needs to go out there and say, look, I am a max player for a reason, all right? And even if I'm not getting touches, even if I only get 5 shot attempts, I can still contribute. And I was critical of Love's performance in Game 5, but people came back at me and said, well, what about his plus 18? All right, in the plus minus. And I do put weight in the plus minus. I do think, you know, there are instances where it can be, misconstrued. But in this case, I thought Love was more along for the ride on the plus 18 than he actually contributed. But when I looked at the game again, I saw some things that I didn't necessarily see that Love was doing off the ball, the non-box score contributions. So Love is capable of playing well and not scoring at a high volume on this team. Now, if he were still on the Timberwolves, he'd have to score 30. But with the Cavs, he doesn't have to score at a high volume. He can still contribute. But as I said several times so far in this, chat with you, Bob, I think that not only is Kevin Love going to have to play well off the ball and he's going to have to rebound tonight, he's going to need to score at somewhat of a volume in order for this team to win.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say, Dennis. And one other thing, excuse me. In fact, hold on. Let's hear from Love, because we heard from LeBron about Love. This is just a little bit of Kevin Love from practice, and I believe this was yesterday. So just a little bit from him talking to the media about his role and what his expectations are. Let's see if we can make this work here. Hold on. It looks like I've got a...
What they did, both scoring 41. Kyrie, shooting above 70%. Braun with, really filled up the stat sheet in every way. So it was great to be a part of. And you had to find different ways to affect the game that might not show up in the stat sheet. Every game is different. I think every game in the entire playoffs has been different. But they're a team that, especially now with Bogut out, probably play a lot of small ball. You'll see Draymond at the five, we're thinking. And, you know, Azili will come in and they'll have a lot of different players subbing in and out of their lineup. So, but we know that the crowd is going to be on our side, and we're going to have to play really, really good basketball and play better than we did last game.
Okay, now I'm going to pause that there and bring up two things. One about your plus-minus. I heard a stat today, earlier today, from P.J. Carlissimo, which is very interesting, that when the Cavaliers went big, meaning they had Tristan and Love on the floor together, they did so for 29 minutes of the 48. And in those 29 minutes that Love and Tristan played together, they were plus 13. When they were small, when they went small, the Cavaliers were plus 2, meaning one or both of those guys were not on the court. They were only plus 2. So it would seem to me that what Love just said, and kind of what you said, and kind of what LeBron said we need him to impact the game, however it is, whether it's scoring or not. And you said things that aren't necessarily read in the box score, and he referenced the same thing. Something helped when he and Tristan and the other three starters were on the floor together. They were plus 13. When he or Tristan was down, they were plus 2. Let's go ahead and hit that one first. Your thoughts on that stat?
Well, yeah, I think there's a myth or a misconception about playing the Warriors and playing their small lineups that you have to go super small in order to beat them. Oklahoma City was at its best when a guy like Steven Adams was out there, okay? Adams is an athletic big, but, you know, they had guys like Ibaka out on the floor. They had Adams. They had Cantor in there for a while. So you don't have to go with five guards to try to play Golden State. If you have athletic bigs, guys like Thompson and Love, who can either be athletic in the paint or space the floor. So Love certainly has a role to play, although I don't think this is a great matchup for him. The way the Warriors take away the pick and pop and the way they take away space, I think that's part of the reason Love's shots are down, is because his opportunities are down, because Golden State has taken him away. But he can still be important in this game. And, you know, so that's, yeah, I agree with all the intangible stuff, all the non-box score contributions, but I keep coming back to the fact that this is a game where I believe that Love's going to have to score at somewhat of a rate. I'll throw this number out, Bob.
All right.
Let me guarantee to your listeners, if Love and Smith combine for 28 points, the Cavs will win.
I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that because I think that can happen. I really do. Even, and I don't know how much of it will be from each guy. I tend to think that Smith would carry more of that because he likes, you know, letting it fly at home. He loves the crowd. He loves hearing the swish, the whole nine yards. He's in such a comfort zone. And he has not been as much so on the road, and I think he knows he needs a big-time performance. Whether we get one from Love or not is the question. Now, to the second part of that, Dennis, you said, you know, he needs to be coddled. He, you know, every star player isn't necessarily a rock solid guy emotionally and mentally. Sometimes guys are fragile. Some guys have rabbit ears. They're called sometimes a little sensitive, if you will, to criticism. And I wonder how this will impact him, if at all, if he even is even aware of it. I have to believe, given players today and their proclivity to social media, and not everybody goes into social media dark mode as LeBron does, apparently, but there is a GoFundMe account that has been set up by Cavs fans to pay Kevin Love to sit out Game 6. They're out there saying, we don't want you, don't play, we're better without you, yada, yada, yada. I didn't look at it. I haven't seen how much it is raised. I know the goal, of course, in a joking and jesting way, is let's raise his entire $10 million annual salary, and maybe he'll just agree to sit tonight. But that's the kind of thing you can't have from a home crowd. If a guy, as you point out, needs to be quote unquote coddled, they need to be behind him. They need to cheer him. And if he starts out 0-for-4, they can't get on him, or you are going to mentally lose him and any production he might have been able to bring you.
I hear you, Bob. There's no way, and if I'm wrong on this, I will be shocked. There's no way that the crowd is going to get on Kevin Love tonight. No chance. They're going to try to support him as much as they can, because they recognize, you know, the gravity of this situation, how important this game is. It's bigger than one guy. So he will get all the support he needs from the crowd tonight. Maybe not the GoFundMe pages and the people outside, but inside the arena. Absolutely, he will feel great. And clearly his players, like him, at least from what we read and what we hear. I mean, I was reading Richard Jefferson Players Tribune article that he wrote, or, you know, I think it was yesterday, where he's talking about how excited he was about tonight. And, you know, he's referencing how the team loves each other and, you know, they support each other. And he was basically saying that Kevin Love is just fine and everybody likes little Kev and all that stuff. So I think maybe we make too much out of it, the fact that there's anxiety between Love and his teammates or his teammates and Love. So everything should be fine tonight. There should be a clear head for him, no excuses, just relax, you know, and, you know that the King and KI are going to take most of the, you know, the hits. They're going to be the ones that have most of the responsibility, so you can relax and just say, do your job, and if you do your job, you're going to help the Cavs' chances immensely.
Two more quickies, D-Man, and we'll let you out of here. Thanks for your analysis and predictions and preview of game number 6 at Quicken Loans Arena tonight between the Warriors and the Cavaliers in game number 6. First of all, Draymond Green said point blank, if I would have played game 5, I believe we would have won. Does he overstate his value? Is that bulletin board like for the Cavaliers? How do you feel about his return? Knowing that, by the way, you know, he's a guy that he's another flagrant away from another suspension. And if he's not careful, if he goes and jerks around today and does something stupid, whether he's baited or not, you know, he could end up being missing out on a potential game 7 in his own building. So, you know, he's going to have to watch himself and not play the loose, free kind of game, the wild kind of game sometimes that he's known for, so that he doesn't get himself a seventh flagrant foul, or I'm sorry, another flagrant foul, and miss a potential seventh game of the NBA Finals. What do you think is going to happen with him?
Well, number one, you know, if I were Draymond Green, and thank God I'm not, I would have the confidence, too, to say that, you know, my team would have won if I would have been on the floor. Number two, Green is going to have to pick up a player and throw him in the stands in order to get a flagrant. There's no way that the NBA wants to see this guy suspended again. So Green is probably going to have a long leash. He's probably going to be able to get away with a lot tonight, as he usually does. But, you know, he absolutely is important to this team and to the Golden State Warriors. There's no doubt. I don't like him. I can't stand him. His nickname's Illegal Screen Green for a reason, because, you know, he gets away with a whole bunch of crap, but he's an incredibly talented player, and he impacts a game at both ends of the floor. And so, yes, you know, he has a right to think that he's a big piece, and he has a right to feel like...
Do you agree with him, though? Do you agree with him? If he had played game 5, and you saw what you got from LeBron and Kyrie without him being there... Do you think Golden State is already wearing those new championship rings?
I'm not going to say that, Bob, because it's such a hypothetical. Here's the key. The answer will come, the answer to your question right there will come tonight. Because if Golden State plays really well and beats the Cavs and Green is impactful, then I absolutely believe the series would have been over in 5 because Green was on the floor. But if the Cavs win tonight with Green out there, then you're not going to convince me that it was an automatic in game 5 either.
Okay, fair enough. And then last thing, if Golden State closes this out tonight, is there a clear-cut MVP thus far for the Warriors? I can't say Steph Curry, who was pretty much invisible in games 1 and 2, had a dynamic game 4, I guess it was. Yeah, 4, when he had 38 points. He was okay in game 3, but irrelevant because the Cavs blew him out. And then, you know, went back to somewhat moderate success with the poor shooting numbers in game 5. If they win, it can't be Steph. It certainly can't be Green. It can't be Iguodala again. Is it Clay? Is there a clear-cut leader for that?
Well, I think it very well could be Draymond Green if Green plays great tonight, and then you see the value of Green. And I think voters, or whoever gets the vote, I don't know how many votes are tallied, but, you know, they say, okay, well, this just shows how valuable Green is because
that's different, I think, Dennis, isn't it? When you talk about most valuable player in a season, it's value.
Yeah.
You know, if he's not there, but
this
player, is
yeah.
You know, who played who right. led you to the championship in your series, and if you
that's
missed the whole game because of, you know, for disciplinary reasons, how can you say he led you to your championship?
Good point. Yeah, it should really be most outstanding, MOP. You know, most outstanding player,
like they do in the Final Four.
You make a point. So it probably won't be Green. If Curry, I think if whoever of Curry or Thompson, if they go off for some ridiculous number tonight, and clearly they were the reason, or one of those two was the reason that the Warriors won Game 6, then I think that's your MVP. It could also be Iguodala if LeBron struggles tonight. You will have looked back and said, Iguodala did it again. You know, for the most part, Iguodala gave LeBron problems in two
games. Yeah, but without Draymond Green to help him last game, we saw what Iguodala is one-on-one with LeBron. And that's a guy who's unable to check him any more than most other guys are. You know what I mean?
That's a good point. Yeah.
That's the thing.
I hear you.
Especially Bogut, too, without Bogut. You know, without Bogut and LeBron, I mean, and Draymond Green, I mean, Iguodala's no matchup for LeBron any more than most other defenders are. D-Man, who wins tonight? Is it champagne-smelling visitors' locker room for the second straight year that Steph Curry can come back next year and make fun of? Or are we going to Game 7 on Sunday?
Again, Bob, I got to stick with what I originally thought. I think that Warriors are too good. It's no shame to lose to them. I think that the Warriors pull it out tonight.
All right, Dennis Manilov predicting doom and gloom again, not wishing for, but calling it a Warriors championship tonight. I'm glad you were wrong on Monday, and I was wrong with you. I hope you're wrong again, and we are talking about a championship game like 7, and no matter how it turns out when we get back together again on Monday. Sound good?
Thanks, Bob.
All right, brother. Good stuff. Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate the time. All right. NBA Finals conversation, obviously, is back hot and heavy today because of game number 6. We want you to be involved in that as well. So make sure you dial up 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065 when you get an opportunity. We'll put you up and on the radio. Don't forget you can tweet to us as well. I've got Adam Silver. Adam Silver made some comments on a national radio show. I'm going to play for you in just a bit after this timeout. This is the addressing and the defense of the league's suspension of Draymond Green for the accumulation of flagrant foul points in the postseason. Very interesting explanation made by Adam Silver. I want to play it, see if you agree with it, see if you disagree with it, because I'm tired of the notion that there's some sort of an asterisk that has to be placed by a Cavaliers win last game, and if they come back and win this title, that it would be tainted in some way because the league somehow had it in for the Warriors and Draymond Green and wanted the Cavaliers and LeBron James to stretch this to at least a 7-game series. Really, really interesting comments from the commissioner. I'll play those for you on the other side. And then also, by the way, Tim Donaghy. It's funny, we've talked about him 2 or 3 times this week. The former disgraced NBA official who went to prison for fixing games and giving a lot of credence to conspiracy theorists who say the NBA is always fixed, these officials are on the take, et cetera, et cetera. He said that there's no doubt that the NBA was fixing things, if you will, manipulating things to make sure that the Cavaliers did get Draymond Green suspended and were able to push through to a game 6 and then hopefully beyond that. So there's a lot of that conspiracy stuff going on. I'm going to let you hear from the commissioner coming up. And then don't forget, after the top of the hour at about 4:05, 4:10, we're going to dive into Mount Rushmore, Ohio State style. We did the Michigan team yesterday. We got some Ohio State today. NFL.com and CFB, which is College Football 24/7. They are doing this for the top 10 programs that have turned out star players or turned out players to the National Football League. Michigan and Ohio State are among them. They're naming the Mount Rushmore for each of those schools. And there will be a Notre Dame sighting as well. We'll get into all of that as we continue today as well on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
He won games last season for Sheehan. They have also signed Brian Lashoff to a 2-way contract between Grand Rapids and Detroit. He'll make $650,000 if with the Red Wings. Breaking sports news first here on The Ticket.
When you or a loved one gets a cut, scrape, or burn, use Bactine. Bactine doesn't sting, and it cleans and protects the area from infection. Relieves pain on contact. Bactine, first aid relief for over 60 years. Learn more at Bactine.com.
When just the thought of travel holds you back, choose Once Daily Bonine. Bonine Special Formula treats and prevents the symptoms of motion sickness, but with less drowsiness than original Dramamine. Bonine Chewable Tablets. Same relief as original Dramamine, less drowsy.
You're about to whip up some delicious steaks, but the wind blows out your propane grill flame.
First, turn off the gas and open the grill lid. Check your grill manufacturer's instructions for when it's safe to relight the grill, or leave the gas off and the lid open for at least 5 minutes before relighting. Never lean over the grill during lighting or cooking. For more advice, give us a call today.
This message is brought to you by the Ohio Propane Education and Research Council.
Can't get enough of Bob France and the Afternoon Extravaganza? Check out the podcast now at 1065theticket.com.
It might seem crazy what I'm about to say.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 1065 The Ticket.
Yeah, indeed. And make sure you check out the webpage. You just heard 1065theticket.com. We are indeed expanding our social and digital footprint online. So make sure that you listen to the podcast. If you ever missed something that you wanted to hear, if you just missed a show and you don't know if you wanted to hear it or not, but you want to check it out, download this podcast and listen to them whenever it is convenient for you. Also, make sure you get on our social media feeds and chat with us on Twitter at Sports Radio 1065 and on Facebook at 1065 The Ticket.
And just before the show started, I put a Mount Rushmore of a whole bunch of schools for me on that list. So go to our Facebook page and let the debate there begin as well.
From you said?
Yes, and not just Michigan, Ohio State. I threw Toledo and Bowling Green in there as well.
You mean your own personal
choices? My own personal choices.
All right,
yes.
I'm looking forward to seeing that. Maybe we can discuss some of those too.
Sure.
I thought you meant that from your account you posted them from the NFL site.
No, I threw mine gotcha. Out there because it took me a day to really narrow some of these down, to be honest with you.
No, of course, yeah. And we'll kick those around, obviously, when we talk. We're going to talk with Luke Zimmerman from LandGrantHolyLand.com, an SB Nation Buckeyes website, about the Buckeyes, Mount Rushmore, and then more, obviously coming up after the top of the hour. But I want to finish this hour with the NBA because, obviously, Game 6 tonight, and we started it that way with Dennis Manilov. I promised some Adam Silver. Adam Silver was on with Dan Patrick, and he was talking about Draymond Green, and he was asked, hey, you know, Reggie Miller and Jeff Van Gundy both said this is bogus, that he should not have gotten a flagrant one and he should not have been suspended. And Miller said specifically that if the series was 2-2, he would not have gotten suspended. Instead, because Golden State was up 3-1, that's why he was suspended. Reggie Miller, essentially, who works for the NBA by way of Turner, Reggie Miller essentially said, or I'm sorry, is he Turner or is he ABC and ESPN? I can't remember which one actually Reggie is.
Reggie Miller is on the Turner one because I recall seeing him on TNT during
the
season.
That's right. Okay. Well, anyway, essentially what he's saying, and he works for the league, is that the league was trying to give the Cavs a break so they could extend this series. He is accusing the league of, and Kiki Vandeweghe and by extension his boss, Adam Silver, of making a decision on whether or not something was flagrant based upon the series total. You know, the score, the games, that it was 3-1 Golden State, and they didn't want to see the series end in 5. So if Draymond Green plays, it's pretty obvious at home, Golden State's going to end this in 5. But if we take one of their key components out of this equation, maybe the Cavaliers can win there and extend this series at least a game, maybe 2. So Reggie Miller is accusing the league of essentially tampering with results for the by way of giving the undeserved, in his mind, flagrant foul to Draymond Green in order to extend the series. Jeff Van Gundy said something similar. He didn't actually mention the 2-2 or the 3-1, but he said that this absolutely was unnecessary and it was a big mistake by the league to suspend Draymond Green. This was Adam Silver's response.
I saw it, and I disagree with both of them. I think, first of all, it's just to be absolutely clear, we did not suspend Draymond Green. We upgraded an act on the floor to a flagrant one. As Draymond has acknowledged, he put himself in that situation. By virtue of his having gotten a flagrant one, he exceeded the number of flagrant points you could get throughout the playoffs and not get suspended. So, in other words, once he got the flagrant one, having already had 3 flagrant foul points throughout the playoffs, that put him over the limit, and he was automatically suspended for the next game. And so then the question becomes, should we have not have given him the flagrant one, knowing that the outcome would be for him to be suspended? And I can only imagine what people would have said on the other side of the argument. Had we not given the flagrant when we saw an act, and act to Draymond's credit, he acknowledged it. There was no dispute as to what happened. The referees did not see it on the floor. There's also no question. They didn't see it and decide it wasn't a flagrant. They didn't see that act when he swiped over at LeBron and hit him in the groin area, and that is a flagrant in our league. I will say in the case of Draymond, I think he knows it, that he wasn't about to get the benefit of the doubt either based on his prior conduct. And the purpose of that rule, and by the way, in terms of Reggie, or Jeff Van Gundy, I'm fine with the conversation if people want to disagree with it, but the theory behind having, in essence, progressive discipline by having it act in a cumulative way was to disincentive guys from committing those acts over and over again. And it's one of the reasons why we don't reset after every round of the playoffs. We don't want guys to think, all right, I got a few flagrants I can get. Yeah. Oh, great, now I can start over. I'll get a few flagrants more. As you know, the genesis of these rules, and by the way, for those who've been criticizing these rules, they've been in place for about 20 years now, and the purpose of these rules was to cut down on the amount of fighting on the floor. As you know from the old days in the NBA, mm-hmm. fights used to break out all the time. I know you can have the images of David Stern courtside. There's some great video of him where players are spilling into the stands, other times where they're showing the look on his face as players are swinging punches at each other. And the idea was there's no place in our game for that. And so one of the ways we thought we could crack down on that, and I was at the league at the time these rules were put in place, was to highly disincentivize guys from committing flagrant fouls, which, can lead to players retaliating. And even Draymond's so-called swipe, he even acknowledges he's doing that in retaliation.
Is the groin different, though?
This is the key. This is a great question here. Is the groin different than hitting somebody in the head or anywhere else? And as Adam Silver points out, yes, it is very, very different.
Yes. The head and groin are different and always have been in this league. And you have to assume that there's a reason, too, why players take shots at other players' groins or possibly their head, as opposed to a guy's back. And I'd say where Draymond loses the benefit of the doubt here is, let's just say that, and I'm not saying Draymond said this, but LeBron just happened to turn at the last second and he hit him in the groin instead of the stomach or instead of the shoulder. And the fact is, this has been conduct that has been ongoing throughout the playoffs. And again, that's the purpose of these rules. And it was for us at the league office, the last thing we want to do, of course, is impact the competition by suspending a player, especially during a fantastic finals like this. But we have to call them as we see them. And again, I hear Reggie and Jeff Van Gundy, but the notion we sit around the league office, do we take a big gulp and say, we're adding up the flagrant points and, this is a flagrant one, that means he's at four, that means he's get suspended. Of course we're aware of that, but I just can only imagine if we had said, he did it, but it's such a great matchup. It's unfair to the fans to have to lose an all-star player in the middle of a great series like this. We won't do it. There would have been just as much outcry from the other side.
That's exactly correct. That is very well said by Adam Silver, the commissioner. There would be, and justifiably so, a huge outcry from the other side. The other side happens to be this side, the side that most of us sit upon, and that is, of course, hoping that the Cavaliers can find their way to win the first championship for the state of Ohio. Literally the first pro championship since 1990 in the Cincinnati Reds. But very well said. If Draymond Green had thrown that backhanded punch to LeBron's hip, if he had thrown it to LeBron's rear end, if he had thrown it to LeBron's back, he's not suspended. But he took a shot at the groin intentionally and, did that backhanded punch to the groin intentionally after going after Steven Adams to that area twice before, of course. He loses any benefit of the doubt. I thought it was important to hear from Commissioner Adam Silver to put any of those conspiracy theories to bed. I hope that does it. If you want to talk more about it, we can do it. But also coming up on the other side of the Sports Center here at the top of the hour, we will indeed get back into the Mount Rushmore carving. Let's blast away at a few mountains and put a few faces up there from Columbus, Ohio, and perhaps from South Bend, Indiana, and more as we continue right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
We have a great opportunity to protect home court and go into two of the best words ever, and that's game seven. You know, hopefully we protect home. That's all that matters.
Take it one game at a time. That's it. I couldn't really think about the what ifs or what could happen, what should happen. I can't really think of that. All I'm really thinking about is the moment that we're in and taking advantage of it.
In a lot of ways, you just try to stay out of their way when they're having such a night like that. Kyrie was, you know, unbelievable, shooting over 70% from the field. Bron has, you know, just been himself.
I have strong belief that if I play game five, we win. But I didn't, because I put myself in a situation where I wasn't able to play. And I think my teammates fought, and it's on me to come out and help that battle. Being a great team has got us this far. So to come back and be a piece of that great team is what I owe to this team. That's what I'm looking forward to doing.
I don't want to be a prisoner of the moment and say game five was a direct reflection of kind of who we are as a team and who I am as an individual, as a player, as a leader. And I was out there, you know, doing what I'm trying to do to help our team win, and it didn't work. So that happens in sports. It happens in our game, and doesn't going to stop me from coming back doing what I do to help lead my team in game six. Yeah, we have a chance to win a championship, so definitely the biggest game, and I'm ready for it.
Takes it out to the 48-yard line. Green sprints out. Sets the throw. Gets it off. Griffin on the sideline. He's got it. Archie's got a first down for the Bucks.
Eddie Durant finds a hole. Sean Wooden runs him down, but it's a big one for Eddie.
The handoff by Hoynes to George in a foot race, and he gets away.
By Chris Spielman, and he might get in. Touchdown, 24 yards, touchdown, Ohio State. Spielman with his fifth interception this season,
which is remarkable for a linebacker. It's incredible.
Big block by the big man, Orlando Pace.
When you were at an Ohio State game, he might have been the guy you were watching when the ball was snapped.
Pearson behind Pace, touchdown.
Creating imaginary statistics, one of them called the pancake, which I don't remember ever seeing in an NCAA record book. And so Orlando Pace led the country in pancakes.
So they have Jumbotron. Every time I would pancake somebody, they'll put one pancake in.
Pace is the pancake man.
I've had good players. Honestly, I don't know how good a coach I am. I've never particularly cared. I think I'm a terribly lucky coach. You give me the same material as anybody else, I think I'll beat him on my luck, if nothing else. All things say, I don't care if we win or not. We don't want him. Because we do want to win. Because winning is the epitome of team effort. And we must keep that, and we must inculcate that into our football players.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
I don't want to belabor the point, seriously, but I'm going to say it again. Jim Cushlin producing the show today and putting that outstanding piece of production together. That montage, obviously just transitioning right from the NBA Finals discussion we had last hour into the Ohio State Mount Rushmore discussion we are about to have. Cushlin, well done, good sir.
Thank you very much.
You know what I love the best about it is I challenged Cushlin yesterday when we did this with Michigan and their Mount Rushmore. We started with Michigan. No slight, obviously, to Buckeyes fans, obviously. Please make sure everybody knows that. But the Michigan one was the first one that I came across on CBS, and I sent it to Cush a few days ago, and I said, hey, we got to talk about this at some point. What a really, really great discussion topic. The four, you know, Mount Rushmore faces to be carved into eternity in the side of a mountain for the University of Michigan. I said, and when we're done with that, we'll definitely do Ohio State and some other ones. And then come to find out, the Michigan one I saw just happened to be one of 10, including Ohio State. And so one of the challenges that I gave him yesterday was, you know, when you do a little montage of the Michigan players, I don't know how you're going to do it with Bo. I guess just find something inspirational that Bo said, because Bo is going to be on the Mount Rushmore for the University of Michigan. And then I said, you know, with respect to Ohio State, you know, what are you going to do with Orlando Pace? How many different ways can you, you know, a play-by-play call is going to be of the runner scoring right. The touchdown behind Orlando Pace killing somebody, or Orlando Pace
I'll freely admit that was my toughest one.
Yeah, and you found actual broadcasters giving descriptions of the pancake stat, including Orlando himself talking about it.
Oh, that once I found that, I'm like, that's it right there.
That was well done, brother.
Because I do remember that. I had never heard of that until I was a teenager and Orlando Pace was playing at Ohio State. I had never heard that term before. Now they still throw it around out there for linemen as some kind of way to keep stats, because offensive linemen, the only technical stat they could ever have is games played and games start, unless you count their penalties.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, I do have to say, though, Orlando Pace played at Ohio State what years? He was drafted in 97, so he played at Ohio State from that would be 93 to 97. Okay.
In that neighborhood, yeah.
Yeah, I have to say they may have popularized the term pancake block with Orlando Pace, but I would be really, really shocked if my memory is completely failing me. And that in 1987 or 8 or whatever year it was, that Tony Mandarich was on the cover of Sports Illustrated with the headline "The Incredible Bulk," and he was described by Sports Illustrated as the best offensive line prospect ever. 6'6", 315, rock solid, obviously, because now we know of the juice and everything else. Once he got rid of that, he was very, very average, but. At any rate, I thought they used the term pancake block a few years earlier with Tony Mandarich, and that was in the late 80s, was it not?
Yeah, that would have been the late 80s.
So I think maybe I don't think they created that term for Orlando,
but they popularized it.
I think maybe they, you know, really kind of grew, I guess, because he was doing so many of them. But Tony Mandarich is, I think, the first place I heard or read that, and maybe I haven't read it in Sports Illustrated. By the way, speaking of Tony Mandarich, you know, we should probably do something. Did you do Sparty on your little Facebook thing, Kush?
No, I didn't actually do it. I didn't think. That's my bad. I should have done them, too.
Yeah, that's okay. You already went farther than I would have, because I just figured we'd take calls on this and get everybody to nominate their Mount Rushmore for their favorite schools. But on the Facebook page, Jim went ahead and threw up on ESPN 106.5, the Tickets Facebook page, his personal Mount Rushmore selections from Michigan, Ohio State, Notre Dame, Toledo, Bowling Green, and, of course, his alma mater, Virginia Tech.
I had to. I just had to. And please note, this kind of based on what we were talking about yesterday when we first started this, for me, it's based on what you did in college only,
right.
Not what the pros did, which is part of the whole NFL thing.
And for anybody who missed yesterday's show, we'll clarify this. Now, the NFL, by way of CFB 24/7, they are the ones who started this whole thing by doing the Mount Rushmore from each school, meaning the NFL players who had the best careers from each of those schools. So the four alums of each school who went on to great fame, fortune, and success. Not necessarily the best players while they were at the school. For example, Tim Tebow would be on the Mount Rushmore we're doing at the University of Florida, but he would not be on the Mount Rushmore that the NFL did because he did not make it in the NFL.
The best example of one that the NFL.com actually put out there was on Michigan's. They have Tom Brady.
There you go. Tom Brady, of course, would be certainly in the Mount Rushmore of NFL players from the University of Michigan, but not on the Mount Rushmore at Michigan because he had a good year. But, you know, he wasn't clearly one of the top four players in Michigan history to be on that. He wasn't even one of the top two or three quarterbacks, probably, when you look at Jim Harbaugh and maybe Rick Leach. Maybe he would be in the top three, I guess. I don't know. I'd have to think about that. Desmond Howard's another great example. You know, Desmond Howard would certainly be on the Michigan and is the Michigan list we put together yesterday because his Heisman Trophy, his receiving prowess, his kick return prowess, everything he did at Michigan was just outstanding, one of the greatest players in college football history. At the pro level, his highlight came, really, in the Super Bowl when he was the Super Bowl MVP with the Packers for some kick returns for touchdowns. But, you know, he never made it as a star receiver or really as a star, period, in the NFL, so he wouldn't be on that list. So just to give a little clarity, which brings us to our first guest, or our next guest, I should say, Luke Zimmerman, of course, an Ohio State writer for LandGrantHolyLand.com, which is an official Buckeyes site. On SB Nation, joining us to find the definitive list of Ohio State Buckeyes that would be carved into the side of a mountain commemorating Buckeye football for all of eternity. Luke, how you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing great, guys. Thanks so much for having me back.
Oh, it's good to have you back. This is just one of these really fun, goofy things. You know, about a year ago or so, I think LeBron James kind of started this, hey, the Mount Rushmore of NBA players, who would be on it. He was asked who his are, and then he made the statement saying, I'm going to be on it before I'm done. I don't know who's getting knocked off, but somebody is. And I think that's what kind of launched this now, a very cool, you know, college edition, if you will, on the football side of Mount Rushmore's. So let me throw this at you first. You probably already know since we asked you to come
His
on.
His blood is so Latin.
What in the world is that? You probably already know this since we asked you to come on. NFL.com and CFB 24/7, they identified their top four Buckeyes who would be on the Mount Rushmore of Ohio State football because of their prowess in the pros. They had two receivers and two linemen. They had Orlando Pace and Jim Parker, the linemen, and then they had Paul Warfield and Chris Carter. Any disagreement on the professional qualifications, if you will, of those four guys as far as Buckeyes who made it big at the next level?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of those guys came pretty considerably before my time, but certainly I will vouch for both Chris Carter and Orlando Pace. I think it's a travesty that it took Pace so long to get into the NFL Hall of Fame, because as dominant and incredible as he was with the Buckeyes, I mean, he had quite the career as a perennial All-Pro. He was just, him and Jonathan Ogden are just two guys that I think of as two of the best linemen I've ever seen, and they kind of created that kind of archetype of modern NFL offensive linemen. So I think those guys are more than fine. Jack Tatum was a guy that I think has a case probably at both the college level and the pro level. Also not somebody I was privileged to see play, when their careers were contemporary, but certainly you see the highlight tapes and there's great cases to be made for just those guys as dominant. So I think those are fine. I'm kind of, based on what you guys are talking about in your intro, a little bit more keen on sort of like evaluating it from a college perspective.
Because I get why the NFL did what they did. They're just basically saying, which programs produce the best players and the biggest studs, et cetera, et cetera. And the way they did this, Jim and I were talking about this earlier before you came on, Luke, they decided that the top 10 schools that they would choose to do this with were based upon the total number of NFL players produced by that school. And so obviously Ohio State and Michigan are among them, as are Penn State, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Louisiana State, Miami, Tennessee, and today's edition, USC. Tomorrow would be the last one. They did it in inverse order, by the way. Notre Dame would be number one. And, I get what they did, but we kind of said, okay, now that's cool, but let's take it to who really represents Ohio State football from what they did at Ohio State, not what they did at the professional level and being from Ohio State. So it's with that in mind that we go ahead and we did this a little bit yesterday. And by the way, thank you for throwing Jack Tatum's name in there. That never came up yesterday. Jack Tatum was one of the most dominant defensive players of his era. Some called him a cheap shot artist. Some said he was, a late hitter. Obviously, we know the controversy with Daryl Stingley, the hit in 1977 that paralyzed the Patriots receiver. But you know what? He was a tremendous part of some championship teams with the Raiders. He was all pro, and obviously he was all American as a Buckeye. I hadn't even considered him. I don't know why, because I was watching him back in the late 70s. I was old enough as about a 10, 12, 11, 12-year-old kid to see him. That's a great ad, by the way. So yesterday we threw some other names out there, and here's what people were coming up with for Ohio State at Ohio State. The name of Orlando Pace and Chris Carter, certainly. Chris Spielman, and you heard maybe him in the intro that Jim played in that montage, some cuts from Chris Spielman. Who else, Jim or Cushlin, did we have on this yesterday that we threw up there as possibilities?
As possibilities for the Buckeyes?
Yeah.
Let's see. We had Tom Cousineau.
Dan
Wilkinson.
Big Daddy Wilkinson, yep. That was another good one.
Hopalong Cassidy was
Antonio
one of them.
Antonio Winfield, who was a two-time All-American,
right.
was mentioned by a couple people. And we just kind of, for the sake of it, Luke, we were looking also at Ohio State players whose numbers have been retired. And it is a very select list, obviously a much smaller list than the list of All-Americans. And upon that, you would also find number 10 for Troy Smith, a Heisman Trophy guy, too. So with all of those names floating around in your mind, what four would you identify as the Mount Rushmore of Buckeyes while at the Buckeyes?
Yeah, so I think for me, three spots are pretty much claimed and spoken for. And, you know, I think there's so many great Ohio State Buckeyes that it's a fun debate just because there's not really wrong answers, right? The three for me that I think are absolutely solid, Orlando Pace, as you guys mentioned, Archie Griffin, obviously the only two-time Heisman Trophy winner, and someone who really just, you know, I think I saw that CBS did one and they had, like, Woody Hayes in it, and that's fine. I think Woody's impact is, you can't understate how important he was. I know, you know, that we all tried to gloss over a little bit the unpleasant ending of his time with Ohio State, but he did so much for the school before and after, and I think that's a fine one to include. But I like to stick to just players, and I think if you're going to talk about the quintessential Woody Hayes player, Archie Griffin, you know, on and off the field, you know, completely fits that mold. So you've got Orlando Pace, Archie Griffin. One that I don't think you guys mentioned, I think it's just so important to the foundation of Ohio State football and really turning around what had been a slow start in the first two decades of Buckeye football is Chick Harley. He gets credit for being the man that built Ohio Stadium, you know, not literally certainly, but I think his legacy reverberates throughout, you know, really all the eras of Buckeye football that followed. And, you know, of course, none of us were around to maybe a couple of your listeners, but not a ton to see him back in the heyday. But I think, you know, even though he comes from almost 100 years ago, I think that's a player that you want to include. The fourth is where it gets really difficult. You know, who is, you know, Chris Spielman is a great one. You know, with a lot of other big names that you come up with, there's always kind of a little bit of a but. I think Troy Smith is arguably the best quarterback statistically and just to the eye test in Ohio State history, but just sort of how his career ended, I think kind of leaves a little bit of a sour taste just because it's so recent still too. I think, you know, Tatum was the name that I mentioned as a guy that could fit both the pro and the college one.
Absolutely.
If you want to get a little hipster, you could maybe go into like Antoine Winfield just in terms of, you know, the Jim Thorpe Award winner. One of the, you know, he played at the same time, or I think his career went 1 year longer than Charles Woodson at Michigan. Woodson was an incredible, prolific athlete who I think is one of the best all-around college players. But he's a guy that, besides playing, you know, great shutdown defensive back, was also playing on offense and starting on special teams. Winfield was also, I think he just, like, he gets forgotten about how dominant he was at corner because he's a little undersized. But he played at the same time, and I think he might have won the Thorpe Award the year after Woodson won it in, like, 97 or 98.
Yeah.
And to me, he's still one of the, you know, he had a long, he's a guy that you can make a case for with a pro career because he had a great, you know, NFL career as well. But he's just one of the most dominant college corners that I can remember. I mean, Sean Springs was a higher draft pick. I don't know that if he was as, he's definitely maybe a better athlete, but, and also had a decent little cup of coffee at the NFL. But I think, you know, some of the names like that are guys that I would consider. It's just so hard. That fourth spot is where it's just like, you know, I don't know if there is a 100% slam dunk answer. Hopple on Cassidy, another old school guy that I think is certainly worth consideration. And, you know, you have some of these guys. I probably wouldn't actually even count Chris Carter just because of like the way his career unfolded. If you're just going to count, you know, kind of success in a vacuum, Maurice Claret's 1 year when he helped Ohio State win a national title was so incredible. Obviously, all the stuff that happened after that makes it pretty much impossible to consider him, but considering what you use to evaluate it, I think the three for me are solid, and the fourth is where you've got probably 12, 20 names that gets much harder to winnow down.
And so the three for you that you said are solid are Pace and Archie and Chick Hearn, right?
Chick Hearn, yep. I'll go with those three.
Okay.
Yep.
Really, really interesting, particularly that you went back to Chick, because I wasn't going to go. I talked about it yesterday very briefly. I wasn't going to go that far back only because, you know, we just don't have film and stuff to, you know, we're prisoners of the moment. We're prisoners of what we can see, and we couldn't see that, so I can't compare how dominant, how much he meant, et cetera. But I was going to go to Vic Janowitz, too, who is a Heisman Trophy winner. Hall of Fame, College Football Hall of Fame, inducted in 1976. He was phenomenal. He was just one of the most tremendous athletes in the history of Ohio State football. And, you know, but the fact is he was there in 1950. So people, we don't have that. We don't have that, game tape, et cetera, to look back at. So you went even further back, than I was with Vic and went to Chick, and that's okay. But it is hard to do. It's hard to compare those kinds of players with more modern players. And there's one name, one more modern player that I didn't hear you say, unless I missed it, because you rambled through a ton of them there. Did you even mention Eddie George?
No, I didn't. And that's another great one. You know, you consider just really the stretch that he had was phenomenal. It's as good as any running back in college football history. I know, I think because of maybe a little bit of the unfulfilled expectations of the season after, but if you look at, you know, 13, 14 months of Ezekiel Elliott, that's another incredible short stretch. Now, I think if you're going to get really legalistic about it, you probably like want to include players that had 3-4 years body of work as opposed to just like an incredible, you know, burnout.
I think so. That's why Maurice Clarett to me would not be included in that, because we're talking about somebody who, if you're carving them into Mount Rushmore, you know, in this mythical thing that we're doing, we're putting their face up there for all time. And to me, for somebody who's going to be there for all time, it has to be an all-time great. And you can't really be an all-time great for doing something for a year. You know, you have to at least had a couple of those years, a couple All-American years, and maybe, you know, 3 or 4 years of impact, maybe highlighted by a couple of All-American years. There were some great linebackers in the history of Ohio State, you know, but to me, to make this list, you really can only go with the greatest linebacker at Ohio State. And some might argue that's James Laurinaitis. Some might argue that was A.J. Hawk. Some might argue that was Tom Cousineau or Randy Gratishar. But for me, it would be Chris Spielman. And Chris Spielman, to me, would be very, very hard to keep off of this list.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, what Chris did and just with the legacy that he built for those guys that came after him and what he fulfilled from those that came before him, I think can't go understated. I joked earlier about Jack Tatum being a hipster pick. If you wanted to be really hipster and talk about a guy that had a really important impact on sort of the evolution of modern Ohio State football, has hardware to show for, a national title, and had an impact across an entire career, how about Braxton Miller? And that's a guy that won 2 Big Ten players of the year, helped Ohio State. Even when he was injured, they wound up winning a Big Ten title and a national championship. He came back against all odds, learned a new position on the fly. Maybe he wasn't the impact player that we'd hoped he'd be at that position, but still, you know, I think had some highlights after doing that. I can't think of many other guys that really transitioned like that. I mean, other than like a Chris Gamble, who was playing two positions at the same time and having to learn them, you know, concurrently. It's tough to think about a guy, and it's just, I think the eras and stuff like that, it makes it so hard to compare. You talked about how, like, even the 50s is a difficult comparison, and just the eras of football and, like, how, you know, even looking back at the numbers, it's just, like, they're so different, like, how people accrued stats, what was even tracked, you know, when you go way, way back in the time. So it's tough. I don't, you know, that fourth one is so difficult for me to pin down, and I think we always are just going to, so many of us, you know, have watched the last 2, 3, 4 decades of Ohio State football, and those are going to be, I think, the ones that we draw from most predominantly, just because they're near and dear to us. We have these emotional memories of the players and sort of seeing it, the eye test that, you know, YouTube clips or whatever don't really compare. But there were just some really greats from yesteryear as well.
No question about it. We're talking to Luke Zimmerman, who is with LandGrantHolyLand.com, an SB Nation website devoted to the Buckeyes, obviously. And I'm going to throw one other name, and I'm not saying he belongs on this list. I just want to hear you talk about him, because you mentioned that Troy Smith is probably the only, you know, he said he's the greatest quarterback in Ohio State history. Ohio State isn't known, really, for turning out a lot of great quarterbacks, as we know. I mean, they've got all kinds of award winners, Doak Walker Award winners, Outland winners, and Lombardi Trophy winners, and this and that. They don't have a lot of Davey O'Brien, although Troy Smith did that. The only other name is Arch Leister, somebody who is a consensus All-American. And we all know how things ended up for Arch Leister. He never had the NFL career he wanted, and he never had the life he wanted because of his gambling problems. But for people who are old enough to remember watching Arch Leister play, and I am, you know, 1980, 1981, he was one of the best quarterbacks in all of college football and was quite frankly, at that time, pretty much the face of the Buckeyes. Outside of Troy, you know, Art is probably the best quarterback maybe the Buckeyes ever had.
I have a counter name to that a lot of people are also not going to like, again, for off the field and attitude reasons. But in terms of accomplishments and statistics, Terrell Pryor put together a body of work as impressive as any Buckeye quarterback ever has. I mean, he led Ohio State to a Rose Bowl, was the Rose Bowl MVP. He was a Big Ten champ 2 different seasons. He was the Big Ten freshman of the year and in a season that's since been vacated, obviously, because of his off the field behavior and actions. He led Ohio State to their first win over the SEC team in a postseason game ever. So that's 3 trips to BCS Bowls in 3 years, Big Ten Freshman of the Year, 2-time Big Ten Champion, 2-time BCS Bowl winner. I know he's not a popular figure, but he also, statistically too, the numbers are pretty impressive in terms of when you look at it in a vacuum. I know it's a very polarizing
You know what's really
figure,
weird?
But
hearing you list all of those accomplishments, is amazing because I sit here as I just look back with a blank slate, okay, and just think, what do I think of when I think of Terrell Pryor? And maybe I'm just a nut, but I bet there are other people who would agree with this. When I just think the name Terrell Pryor, what pops into my head, I think underachieving. It's weird because everything you just said would indicate he achieved a heck of a lot. But I remember the recruitment of Terrell Pryor. I remember what a crazy time that was and about what a celebration it was when he chose Ohio State, et cetera. And he was just redefining, you know, he was this, Randall Cunningham type runner, with a rocket arm and a great passer and a great touch and this and that and the other. And I don't know if maybe just people had an expectation of national championships, or what it was, but, and maybe it's just because, you know, you remember the end and the way things ended up. The vacating of the wins and the season and leading to Coach Tressel and all the rest. But for some reason, I feel like I think of Terrell Pryor and I think incomplete. I feel like didn't do everything he should have done with all of the talent he had while he was here. And maybe I'm the only one who thinks that, but that's kind of an odd.
No, I think sometimes the divorce makes you forget that you were happy at one point in the marriage. So now I remember his first real impact game when he came into that lost trip to USC when Chris Wells was out with an injury and Ohio State got their tail handed to him, but Pryor was, you know, wound up taking over the quarterback job and played pretty competently for a freshman. They did some interesting maneuvering, kind of rotating him and Todd Beckman, who had led Ohio State to a national title loss the season before after that. But he kind of, you know, had something special to him from the get-go, and I think maybe he didn't progress as much as a passer as many would have liked, but stuff gets forgotten about too. I mean, he was super hurt in that Sugar Bowl game, and he really played a really gutty game and was really effective as a passer and a runner against a good Arkansas team, a top 10 Arkansas team. So it's really hard. I feel sort of the same, like unfulfilled potential. If somebody asked me, you know, describe Terrell Pryor in a couple words, that's probably what would be the first thing out of my mouth too. But he had a heck of a career. Is frustrating and everything that happened, and it's just, you know, again, I don't think you can separate the bad and sort of that vortex or black hole of negativity away from it, but right. Yeah, I mean, that's another Schlichter, you know, a little bit before my time, but one of the things that I remember from looking at him for like a similar exercise to this a couple of years ago on our website was that he threw like a ton of interceptions. Like, the guy had awesome passing numbers, awesome touchdown numbers, awesome rushing numbers for a quarterback, but he, like,
especially for the era, because definitely before the spread era and before the the evolution of the passing games at the college and the NFL level, actually.
Yeah, and like the Schlichter I remember when I was first getting into sports as like a young kid is, you know, kind of the fall from grace. So that's like what sticks out to me. And it's just, there's the politics of it is weird. I mean, and who knows, like the incredible old timer guys that we're naming, like there was no level near the kind of scrutiny or the coverage or really any of that. It's like the off the field stuff, who even knows, you know?
Right. And you know, the other thing too is you could also blame Art Schlichter in some capacity for what happened to Woody Hayes, because he's the one who threw the pick that led to Woody Hayes punching Charlie Bowman, the Clemson linebacker that ended Woody Hayes' career as the coach of the Ohio State Buckeyes. So Schlichter not only dragged himself down, but he threw the pick that ended up getting his coach fired too. And I say that, of course, tongue-in-cheek. That's all on Woody. All right, so, Luke, we got to run, but let's nail this down. I hate to make you do it. You threw out so many great names there. You said Pace, Griffin, Chick Harley. Those are your three. And the last one, you named about 20 guys. But I'm gonna make you pick one because the mountain is too big to put 20 heads on. Only one other head can go.
I think you talked me into Chris Fieldman. I think he's what he accomplished and just sort of the legacy that he started and the impact. You know, right after my college career, you know, there's guys like A.J. Hawk, Bobby Carpenter, James Laurinaitis, who was, you know, the latter was on into a great pro career. A.J. Hawk also had a very good pro career, won a Super Bowl. And that those just don't happen. Like, that model for linebacking is all based on sort of the legacy and the foundation that Chris Fieldman laid. So I'll go with him as my fourth. It also gives us, you know, a little bit of representation on both sides of the ball, so we're not just all offensive. And I'm pretty good with those four, I think.
I like it. I think it's very well done. And I got to tell you, Jim and I are both kind of on the side of CBS in this, by the way. When they put Bo Schembechler on the mount for for Michigan. They did the same thing with Woody. I don't think you can say, hey, this is Ohio State football to somebody, you know, 150, 250 years from now. And this mountain, they say, what are those? What are those four heads that are carved in that mountain? Well, that represents Ohio State football. I don't think you can represent Ohio State football historically to me without Woody Hayes being carved into that. So for me, it'll be Pace, Griffin, Spielman, you know, from the ones he did. I guess I would replace Chick Harley with Woody Hayes for that reason. Again, there's no right or wrong on that, but I think Bo is Michigan. I think Woody is Ohio State. No matter what happens in the next 200 years or more, I think they always will be. And that's just you know, a personal decision whether you want to leave all players or if you can add other features onto that mountainside. Luke Zimmerman, great stuff, man. Really enjoyed the discussion. We look forward to talking to you much more frequently as we get closer and closer to camp time this late summer and early fall, and we get another season underway. Sound good?
Sounds like a plan. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. We appreciate it, Luke. Luke Zimmerman, LandGrantHolyLand.com, a part of SB Nation. Kush, you're with me on that, right? We kind of settled this yesterday that we're going to have three players in Woody. Not every school's going to have that, by the way.
Right.
I mean,
yeah, if your coach is truly legendary, then
now,
he can
now,
go
the
up
key
there.
To the key question there, Jim, though, I'm sure you realize, is when we get to a place like Penn State,
yep.
They tore down Joe Paterno's statue because of, you know, the obvious reasons, you know,
right.
his involvement in the scandal off the field. They literally took down that monument. Statues are supposed to be forever. A mountainside literally is forever unless
right.
somebody takes some blasting caps up there and just destroys it. Would you include the man who at one time was the all-time winningest coach in college football history, more games than anyone ever, and he built Penn State football into what it is and became? But do you immortalize a guy with you know, like I said, with a background at the end that forced them to actually take down the statue of him? So that's something to talk about when we get to some of those other schools. All right, I'm going to need a timeout here, but before I take that timeout, how about I hook you up with our sweet deal of the week from The Ticket and 1065theticket.com. This week, $50 gift certificates to Sidelines Sports Bar and Eatery with four locations in the area, two in Toledo, one in Lambertville, one in Maumee. And all you've got to do is get a $50 gift certificate for just $25 tomorrow morning while supplies last, starting at 9 a.m. on the website, 1065theticket.com. $50 gift certificate for $25 starting tomorrow morning. But to launch this sweet deal, I'm going to hook you up with a $50 gift certificate for $0 right now. If you're caller 10, 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065, that prize will be yours. On the other side of this timeout, let's take some of your phone calls. What do you think about that? We talked about it yesterday, obviously. What do you think about that Buckeye Final Four that we've kind of pieced together here? Pace, Griffin, Spielman, Hayes. Those are the ones that we kind of consolidated on here, even though Luke, our guest, said Chick Harley for the fourth spot on the Buckeye mountainside, if you will. But we want your thoughts on it, too, as we continue right after this on The Ticket.
Oh, back to Bob France, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It is a Thursday afternoon edition of the Extravaganza. Thanks so much for being a part of it. Thanks to Luke Zimmerman for being a part of it, talking Mount Rushmore of Ohio State with us. Thanks to Dick Maniloff, who joined us in the first hour, talking NBA Finals tonight. Cavaliers and Warriors Game 6, a chance to push it to a Game 7. Only the third team, the Cavaliers would be if they do it, to come back from a 3-1 deficit.
And it'd be the first in modern times. The other two were in the ancient days of the NBA.
How ancient are we talking about?
51 Knicks and the 66 Jerry West, Elgin Baylor Lakers, who went down 3-1 to the Bill Russell Celtics, and we know how those stories
there
end.
There you go. Yeah, yeah.
So this would be quite an accomplishment if they get it done. If they just go into Game 7, I'm not talking about winning it, but just going to
right.
Game 7, it'd be the first time anyone's done that after being down 3-1 since 1966. So
hey,
do
I
the
want to share, since we were doing college football this last hour, I want to share the names that are on it from what you know, where we drew this this great topic. The NFL website, NFL.com, and CFB 24/7, College Football 24/7, which is part of it, they named, again, 10 teams, and in inverse order, starting with number 10, the 10th most NFL players produced by a school. And they did it through the top you know, school with the most number of players produced, which would be Notre Dame, and that'll come out tomorrow. So the 9 previous ones, I just want to share them with you. And, again, this is a little different than what we just did with Luke and Jim. as we were listing the best players while they were at the college, what they did at the college level. The NFL's concern is these are the best players from these schools in terms of producing NFL stars. So starting with Tennessee, the Mount Rushmore for Tennessee, Peyton Manning, Reggie White, Jason Witten, and Doug Atkins. That's a really interesting list there, and I really, really think it's one of the stronger lists, to be honest with you, especially those top two. Reggie White, arguably the greatest defensive lineman and defensive end of all time, the Minister of Defense. He's the retired as the NFL's all-time sacks leader. And obviously Peyton Manning, one of the, you know, top two or three quarterbacks to ever play. That's pretty doggone big. And Jason Witten is probably going to go to the Hall of Fame sometime, some year as a tight end. So that's a pretty good list. The number nine team in terms of players produced is the University of Miami. The U's all-time Mount Rushmore includes Ray Lewis, Ed Reed, Jim Kelly, and Michael Irvin. That is a really interesting group for a couple of different reasons. Ray Lewis and Michael Irvin for, yes, their tremendous careers, both of which were marred by various circumstances that I won't get into now.
Various circumstances. That seems to sum up playing for Miami as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. Ed Reed, by the way, just turned into one of the great safeties of his era and maybe of all time. No problem with that at all. And Jim Kelly, I thought was interesting. You know, clearly had the biggest success of all of those great Miami quarterbacks during
no
that
question
run.
There.
When Bernie Kosar and Jim Kelly and Vinny Testaverde and who else? Gino Toretta, all these Heisman Trophy candidates or winners, you know, not all of them went on to great success at the NFL level. Jim Kelly certainly was the greatest of those. The number eight team, beg your pardon, is LSU. LSU's Mount Rushmore includes Jim Taylor. All these are real old except for one. Jim Taylor, Y.A. Tittle, Steve Van Buren, and Alan Faneca. Alan Faneca is the most recent one, of course. He was drafted by the Steelers, was an all-pro guard there for a number of years, and then became an all-pro in New York with the Jets, I believe. And he will be wearing one of those ugly yellow jackets in Canton one day. Number seven was the Oklahoma Sooners. Who are you thinking of first? Are you thinking of Brian Bosworth? He did not make the cut. Even though he was a tremendous player, he did not become a tremendous player at the professional level. Remember, this is the NFL's version of this. So for Oklahoma, there was Leroy Selman, Adrian Peterson, Tommy McDonald, and tight end Keith Jackson. Very, very solid group. For Nebraska, the sixth team, they have Will Shields, Roger Craig, of course, who went on to Super Bowl success with the 49ers, Neil Smith, and Irving Fryer. One of the great wide receivers that I ever remember in college, and he was one of the most highlight, real, productive guys during his time in the NFL, too. Loved me some Irving Fryer. Michigan was, of course, we talked about. They were number five in this. Let me see, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. Yes. Michigan, of course, Tom Brady, Charles Woodson, both of whom will be in the Hall of Fame, Steve Hutchinson, who we'll see, Dan Dierdorf, who is already there. Number four, Penn State. Penn State, Jim, you and I talked about this when we do the whole, you know, college version of this.
Right.
Would Joe Paterno's name and image be carved into that mountain? Since this is about pro players, it doesn't matter here. Penn State's Mount Rushmore by way of NFL success. Jack Ham, Hall of Fame linebacker with the Steelers. Franco Harris, Hall of Fame running back with the Steelers. Mike Munchak, currently head coach and well, former all-pro guard, and Lenny Moore, great running back as well. So that would be Penn State. Number three would be Ohio State, and we already told you who they had, Orlando Pace, Paul Warfield, Chris Carter, Jim Parker. And just to round it out, number two, we can't get to number one because they're not going to release Notre Dame until tomorrow, but number two is Southern California, and my goodness, the number of superstar running backs from that program. And people who didn't even make this cut are some of the greatest of all time, including Frank Gifford. Troy Polamalu didn't make the cut.
Right.
Junior Seau didn't make the cut. O.J. Simpson, again, just the player. First running back ever to go over 2,000 yards, and he did it in a 14-game season. Didn't make the cut. Lynn Swann, Hall of Famer, didn't make the cut. Willie Wood, Hall of Famer, didn't make the cut. That's tough, man. And the ones who did, Ronnie Lott, Anthony Munoz, Bruce Matthews, Marcus Allen. Quite simply, one of the best players at each of their respective positions in history. Ronnie Lott is a safety, Munoz is a tackle, Matthews is a guard, and Marcus is a running back. That is one amazing Mount Rushmore right there, especially when you consider the names that did not get in. And as far as Notre Dame, that's going to be up to what they decide. But just to throw some names at you, Joe Montana, Tim Brown, Hall of Famers both, Jerome Bettis, Hall of Famer, Paul Hornung, Hall of Famer, Rocket Ismail, not a Hall of Famer, Alan Page, Hall of Famer, Dave Casper, Hall of Famer. Good luck narrowing Notre Dame's down to their top four for the Mount Rushmore. Hey, that's all the time we've got. I really enjoyed this fun conversation. I want to say this as we close. I want to say go Cavs, get it to Game 7, stick it straight up Draymond Green's nose, and let's force a Game 7. If there is one, that'll be the next time I talk to you is on Monday, recapping the final game of it, because Jim Cushman will be in for me tomorrow. I got a long weekend planned. Hope you have a great one. We'll talk to you on Monday. Have a great day. Bye-bye.